moment into happy hours. And in just that moment, you change the rain clouds into colors that I can see that your face. You think it's some kind of mistake that you made, but let me put your heart in me. Cause I can't help but just hear you say it to me. Don't come back to the right time. Baby, the right time to come. Cause it is the right time. Back the right time.
It didn't take long before everyone did know. And I all did flock to watch him stand upon the rock. I saw him gather in a long white gown, taking sinners and holding them down. John, John, won't you wash them away? Make us ready for the judgment day. Take us down and hold that thunder. Make the heavens roar with thunder now. The waters are dirty and the reason is Holy John had to wash away our sins. And the waters are dirty and the reason is Holy John had to wash away our sins by and by. Oh, can I cry a little bit? There's nobody to notice it. Can I cry if I want to? No one cares. Why can't I pretend that you love me again? All I've had has been taken from me. Now I'm crying and tears don't become me. Just one smile, pain's forgiven. Just one kiss, now the hurt's all gone. Just one smile to make my life worth living. A little dream to build my world upon. How I wish I could say all the things that I got to say. How I wish you could see what's in my I don't ask for much now, baby. Look, a smile or a touch, and I try to forget. Though the Lord knows I'm trying, but it's hard to forget, girl, when your whole world is dying. Just one smile, pain's forgiven. Just one kiss, now the hurt's all gone. Just one smile to make my life worth living. A little dream to build my world upon.
Thank you.
That's a very moving song. Well, good to see you all here. This was a very tough beginning to this tour. For the past few years, I've been playing at the Throckmorton Theater in Mill Valley. And I was looking at their website. It was about a month before I was going to play this year. And there was nothing on it. So I sent an email, and I said, I think you should put tickets on sale. It's like a month before I'm going to play. And she sent like this casual email back, said, oh, I'm going to be closed the first couple of weeks in January. I thought to myself, well, thanks for telling me. And I went nuts, because you can't get a gig in San Francisco like that. It just doesn't happen, especially like when it's only 30 days to go. So I called Roy Blumenfeld, the drummer from the Blues Project, who's my buddy, and he put a little pizzazz on it, and got some local guy who's an agent here in town, and Yoshi's, which is, you know, maybe a step up from the Throckmorton Theater. Maybe two steps up from the Throckmorton Theater. Said they would be happy to have me. And this day, the Monday after New Year's Eve, is traditionally one of the worst nights in all of nightclubbing. Because, you know, everybody shoots their load on the weekend, and then they gotta go back to fucking work on Monday, and, you know, it's not good. So, I want to thank Yoshi's, and I want to thank Charlie Ellicott, who's the guy who got me in. And most of all, I want to thank all of you for showing up. Woo! And then on top of that, after all this, 3 days before I was going to leave, I live in Boston, and on the weather it says, very bad storm coming in this weekend. And I was supposed to leave yesterday, and that was like the peak of the storm. So then I got on the phone and like changed my flight the day earlier, and there was still storming then, but we got off with only like an hour of delay, which is pretty good in Boston. And so I got here Saturday, and other than going to Down Home Music, yeah. I really haven't done anything. Just been kind of sitting in my room watching the first season of Mad Men on my computer. I know I missed it. I didn't get it at first, so I let it go, and then everybody kept saying, oh, you're missing it. So I bought the first season. And it's like, and it's on my computer, so it's like a great thing to have on tour. And so I didn't know I was going to be sitting around for 3 days, though. So I'm in the sixth episode already. It is good. Now, what was I doing? Oh, I was playing a show. Okay. When I first started playing professionally, I was 14, and I was really lucky to get in this band that had a number one record, the Royal Teens, and who wears short shorts. I was in that band, that's how I started. I was the guitar player in that band. And then I was in that band for about 2 years, and then I got signed to a publisher as a songwriter.
And he put me together with two other guys, and we became, you know, like a songwriting team. It was Bob Brass, Irvin Levine, and myself. And they were two guys from New Jersey that, like, grew up together. And so, you know, they were very tuned into each other. And they were 2 years older than me. So they, like, really, you know, made it tough for me. And but we wrote like a zillion songs. They wrote the words, I wrote the music. So, you know, this Diamond Ring was one of those ones, except that we wrote it as an R&B song, sort of like I played it tonight. And when I heard the Gary Lewis record before it came out, I was horrified. I couldn't believe that someone like got that from the demo we made. We wrote it for the Drifters. And I heard that Gary Lewis record. I said, oh my God. And by the way, Leon Russell arranged the Gary Lewis record. So I might have said in the press, you know, when I started to get famous on my own, that I didn't like the Gary Lewis record. So when I met Leon Russell, he wasn't very friendly. we used to work. We had like a 10 to 6 job, and it was writing songs. So we go to this building on 51st and 52nd and Broadway. It was called 1650 Broadway. And I just want to teach you something now. Everyone says that everything happened in the Brill Building. Bullshit. Everything happened at this place called 1650 Broadway. The Brill Building was down the street. It was 1619 Broadway. And in the 40s and early 50s, a lot did happen at the Brill Building. But around 57, they redid 1650 Broadway, which was also a music business building. And it looked better, and the rents were cheaper, and so everybody went there. So when they say, that song had that Brill Building sound. Carole King and Jerry Goffin, Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, Neil Sedaka, Gene Pitney, Dionne Warwick, all these people were at 1650 Broadway. And all the music that was written and recorded there is what they now call the Brill Building sound. So I just want you to know that. It's not true. And I went to college for a year because of my parents. I come from New York, from Queens, New York. And where I lived, if you didn't go to college, you were a bum. And so it was very important to my parents that I wasn't a bum. So I had to go to college, and I spent all of my high school cutting classes and going to 1650 Broadway. and so I didn't do very well in high school. And so I got into the University of Bridgeport in Connecticut, and I studied music there. And I really didn't like it. They were teaching me to be a music teacher, which I didn't want to be at that time. And they would do things like, hand in my homework, which took me like 3 seconds to do. It was like a Bach chorale, and you had to fill in the top line. And I went, oh, this is easy. And I'd get it back, and there would be old red marks on it. So one day I stayed after class, and I went to the piano. It was just me and the teacher left in the room, and I said, so what's wrong with this? And I played it. He says, that's not the way that Bach wrote it. And I said, well, if you look up from your papers, you would see that I'm not Bach. And he said, "Well, Mr. Cooper, my friend, you have to learn the rules here before you can break them." And I said, "I..." And then I just, you know, sort of hung out for the rest of the year. So I stopped going to classes. And my parents came up because I played in the orchestra. I played bass in the orchestra. And they came to see the orchestra play, and they saw my teacher, and they said, "How's Alan doing?" And I said, "We don't know. He hasn't been to class in 2 months." And so I said, "Give me a year, and I'll do something. I can't stay in the school. It's a waste of my, I'm wasting valuable time here." And so I went, and I, you know, hooked up with Brass and Levine, and we started writing these songs. We wrote, every Monday they'd have a list up on the bulletin board in the front office, and it would say, "Bobby V needs a new single. Leslie Gore needs a new single. Blah, blah, blah," like this. And we'd see that, and then we'd go into our rooms and we'd write songs for Bobby V and Wesley Gore and all these people. And it was very rare that the people that we wrote the songs for did them. But somebody else would do them. But it wouldn't be, you know, like, "The Drifters need a new song." So we wrote this Time and Ray, and then Gary Lewis did it. And I'm telling you, after I said that, "I hate this," to the publisher, it was only 3 months till it was number one. And I said, "I'm getting to like it." But we wrote, like, all these really, you know, bizarre songs. And you know, like, people go to work, you know, and they do people's tax returns, and they... take cases as lawyers and everything. We did the same thing, but we wrote songs every day. And that's what we did for a living. So we'd go to this room that had, like, fake white cork bricks on the ceiling and a piano about half the size of this and a couple of chairs and a door that locked from the outside. And we wrote songs all day long. And we wrote songs like, "Please Don't Break My Brother's Heart," "I Got a Broken Heart for My Birthday," and this next song, which I'm going to play for you now, which we wrote for the Shangri-Las. Remember the Shangri-Las? Well, as I said, the Shangri-Las didn't record this. As a matter of fact, nobody recorded this. And when we made the demo, because that's what you did, you'd go in the recording studio and the three of us would go in and sing the song. I asked the engineer to record us on tape that was slowed down a little bit. And so he looked at me like I was crazy. I said, "Can you do that?" He said, "Yeah." So he did that, and we played and sang it. And then I said, "Put it back to regular speed now." And we sounded like girls. It was good. And that's because, you know, that's what we had to do. We had to sort of sound like the Shangri-Las if they were going to do it. So I don't have really that advantage tonight. So use your imagination. Otherwise, it would appear that I was gay. This is called Junior Was a Heavyweight.
Fists. Junior, Junior,
lights from downtown. They called him Hurricane, but you would never guess that he was 200 pounds of solid tenderness. Junior, Junior. Then came the night when that brave boy of mine was fighting the champ in the middle of now in round nine, when a right hand caught him right between the eyes, and the crowd hushed up like they do when a young man dies. Junior was a heavyweight, fighting only to survive. And though he's gone from me, the men he knew downtown tell me, don't worry, kid, there's lots of other heavyweights around. But not for me. I miss them so much now. Junior was a heavyweight. Junior was a heavyweight.
Woo!
I thought you might like that. I like to lug my guitar around with me so I can play a little guitar. This is a big one, though. So let's see what happens here.
Thank you.
sometimes. Early in the morning, every good day. Fall down on my knees, fall down and I pray. Think about my woman who's all gone, and I can't keep from crying sometimes. I can't keep from crying sometimes. Mama, dead and gone and I'm all alone. I can't keep from crying sometimes. Watch the sun go down. Think about my woman that came around. My heart is filled with sadness and my eyes are filled with tears. I can't keep from crying sometimes. I can't keep from crying sometimes. Working on a new album, and it's going to be more blues oriented than the last couple that I made, just because it's time. This is one of the ones that I've recorded already. This is an old Vineland and Jefferson song that I always really liked, and I had like my own arrangement of it, and came out good. Well, you know, there's a whole band on it. Here I am by myself, so I'll do the best I can.
She said, "There ain't a nickel in all of New York."
I got a big old axe thing crawling in my room. Up here and take this backstage soon. Hello? Hello? No, this is not the Throckmorton Theater. Song on that, what's that, Tears album, and it was the first song that I ever heard by Nelson, and his version of it was unbelievable.
Yeah.
It was really amazing, and I used to listen to it all the time. And so if you're going to do somebody else's song where they made an amazing record, then you can't go and try and imitate that record. I mean, you could, but it's a dumb thing to do. So I was racking my brain to come up with a, you know, some other way to do it, and I was listening to Desafinado by Stan Getz, and I said, Bossa Nova. I could do it like a Bossa Nova. So that's what we did, and it was like, you know, miles away from his version. It didn't have anything really to do with his version, which was good, and so I got to record it. And then I started hearing more songs by him, and I went, uh-oh, I like these, I'm going to want to do more. And then when I was out in California, I got to meet him, and we spent the day at his house, and this was very early on in his career and mine, and we really got along great. He was a great guy. He was very funny. And we were sitting in his house, and we were smoking the bat or lava. And he said, you know, I always wondered if you could swim when you were high. So I said, okay. And he said, let's find out. I said, okay. He says, I got a pair of trunks that would probably fit you. He said, and he had a pool outside. So we got into swimsuits, and I just want you to know, you can't. Mostly because you're laughing so hard. And it's hard to swim and laugh. It's impossible to laugh and swim, actually, because the breaths are misplaced. So that was like, you know, the first day that we met, and that's, you know, we went there. And it got, you know, weirder as it went along.
I can imagine.
And so the next record I made was my first solo album, and I did another one of the songs. And then on my second solo album, I did another one. So there was like three in a row. And he was very appreciative. But we really were good friends, and then he got out of my reach. In that, when I would see him as time went by, he was on Mars, and I couldn't go there. So I go, okay, see ya. But we still were friends, but we just couldn't spend as much time together because I didn't understand that planet that he was on. Then he got ill, and I wanted to do something, so I got all these people together, and we did a tribute album where all these really good singers and songwriters did a Harry Nelson song. We put it all on one album, but he died after. He had only cut three songs, but he did hear the three songs, and he was having a great time with it. And I'm saying all this because I want to play another Harry Nelson song. So I hope that's okay.
Yeah.
One is the loneliest number that you ever do. Since the number one, no is the saddest experience you'll ever know. Yes. it's the saddest experience you ever know. Because one is the loneliest number that you ever do. One is the loneliest number, much, much worse than two. It's just no good anymore since you went away. Now I spend my time just making rhymes of yesterday. Fascinating and weird experience. I used to write, when I started writing by myself, I would wait until I was aroused by something. And it's sort of like when you get hungry or you have to go to the bathroom. You know, it's in that category. It's like, oh, I should make dinner. Oh, I should go to the bathroom. Oh, I feel like I could write a song. But instead of going to the kitchen or the bathroom, you go to the musical instrument. And I sit down and I start playing and singing. And so most of the songs that I've written, the first lines of the songs are stream of consciousness. Because I'm just singing anything and playing anything, and I keep doing that until something sticks. I go, that's good. And I get a pad and I write down that first line like that. And so I started thinking about that one day, and I said, what's my favorite first line that I wrote that just came out of nowhere? And I have to say unequivocally, that is, you left me when the crops was failing and the chickens died. I like that. I think that's, you know, genius. My second favorite, this is more artistic, actually, is why do we try to be what we want to be, if we can never be who we are. That's probably better than a dead chicken, actually. I have to switch that. So one night, I was out in the bars with my friends, and I saw some guy I hadn't seen in a long time, and he said, Al, how you doing? I said, pretty good. He said, remember that girl Martha I used to go out with? I said, oh yeah. She was great. I said, but you haven't gone out with her in a long time, have you? He said, I bumped into her last week. And we went out last night. I said, really? What was it like? He said, well, I think I took a drive through the old neighborhood. And this little went off in my head, and I said, that's a great song title. And I was in the middle of writing a song that was actually about that. And I didn't have a good title for it. So then I had a great title for it. So I'd like to play that for you. And what I like about this song is that, you know, like in like the movies in the 50s, like I think I remember most From Here to Eternity. Anybody see that movie? So there's this scene on the beach where Burt Lancaster and I think it's Deborah Carr are lying on the beach getting ready to do it, and the waves are washing over them, and they're just in bathing suits lying on top of each other and everything. And then the camera pulls back, and you just see seagulls flying. Well, in this song, the camera doesn't move until, like, after the washcloth. No, oh, I should play that on another sound, actually. Sorry.
Tells me how
you spend your time with pills and movie stars. If I get someone to do the dishes and someone to wash my clothes, and I'd take you back. I wouldn't give you no flack, or we'd make up, goodness knows, and I'll be glad to have you back if you just bring the dog and my silk shirt you stole. We'll patch things up the way. When I was about 11 or 12, I got hit with Elvis Presley, and it was a blow I never really recovered from. And I was already playing music, but I was like a piano guy. And then I saw and heard Elvis, and I went, this is for me. Gotta get a guitar, learn how to play the guitar. So I had this really crummy guitar. It was an acoustic guitar with a pickup, but it was an electric guitar. And every day after school, I'll go up to my room and listen to these Elvis Presley records and try and figure what the hell that guitar player was doing, because I loved it. And his name was Scotty Moore. Still is. He's still alive. And there were two other guys. There was a triumvirate that I worshipped back then. It was James Burton, who played guitar with Rick Nelson, and then Cliff Gallup, who played guitar with Gene Vincent. And those were the guys that I worshipped when I was like 11, 12. Matter of fact, when I was 12, I had the day off from school on election day. And let's see, that would be 1956, November, whatever the first Tuesday is in November, 1956. And it was the day that Elvis Presley's second album came out. And so I was all jacked up. I had the money and everything, and I got on my bike, and I rode down to the record store really early. I wanted to be, you know, like the first one in the store kind of mentality. And I got hit by a car. I mean, and I was on my bike, and in such a way that I went like almost straight up in the air on my bike, and then came down like, you know, head first on my bike, you know, like with the bike heading straight for the ground. And I mean, I remember like being as high as the top of the lamppost. And then like this. And it was only about a block away from my house. And I hit the ground, and I got right up, because I was in a state of shock. And the guy said, "You okay?" I said, "Oh yeah, I'm fine." And my hand was all ripped up. I still have a scar from it. And I had braces on, which saved my teeth. If I hadn't had braces on, I wouldn't have had my teeth. And so there was a doctor that lived right on the corner, and he came out, and we went into his office, and he looked at me, and he said, "You're okay, you just need to get cleaned up." So I went back to the house, and I rang the doorbell, and I woke my mother up. She was pissed. She came to the door. "Don't you have your... What happened to you?" Because I was all bloody and stuff. And she was very nice to me. And my father came home from work with a new bike and Elvis's new album.
Aww.
So I just really was mesmerized by that kind of guitar playing back then. So I'd like to play some of that for you, because I never forgot it. As a matter of fact, where I live in Boston, I live in this town called Somerville, which is near Cambridge, or as they say in L.A., it's Cambridge adjacent. And when I moved to Boston, I wanted to live in Cambridge, so I went out with the real estate broker, and she said, "Well, how much do you have to spend?" And I told her, and she said, "You're about $400,000 short for Cambridge." I went, "Wow." She said, "Maybe you should look at someplace adjacent." I said, "Okay." And I picked Somerville, I don't know why. And I got this really nice house for cheap compared to Cambridge. And I have lived a lot of places and all over the place. And this is the first place that I've ever lived, I've been there 13 years now, where I get along with the neighbors. It's unbelievable. It's a whole other way of living. Everybody's nice. What's going on? It's like Stepford Wives. So I love living there. And right across the street from me are a couple. They're both architects, and they both run their own separate businesses. And they have a big, gigantic Christmas party every year. So I went, when we first got friendly with them, to their first Christmas party, and they had a guy playing the piano with a stand-up bass player. I said, "That's cool." And he was a pretty good piano player. And before the next year's party, I said to her, "Can I play this year?" And she said, "Are you serious?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "I'll get a couple of guys from my band." So I got the bass player and the drummer, and we set up by their piano, and we rehearsed two sets. The first set was stuff I used to play in the piano bars when I was a kid, you know, standards and regular stuff like that. So we played that, and nobody paid any attention to us at all. We were invisible, like it was when I played the bars. And the second set, we played all rockabilly songs. And my bass player played stand-up bass. It was fabulous. And people went nuts. Just the opposite of the first set. They were dancing all over the place and going crazy and everything. And I said, "This is good." So I booked some gigs like that with just the three of us, and worked up, you know, more songs. And all I do is, you know, the songs that I heard when I grew up. I don't play any of my songs at all. And boy, is that fun. That's the most fun I have playing now. But it's too expensive to fly them out here. So you're just going to have to put up with me. Song in a show for themselves.
Yeah.
1 out of 15, and that's fair. So this is for me. And if you like it, isn't that fabulous? In my morning, evening time, when I'm with my baby, ain't no fun when the sun's around. I get going when the sun goes down on my way. With my baby, listen, I'm gonna kiss and kiss and kiss and kiss and kiss and gonna kiss some more. Who cares how many times I kiss? Cause at a time like this, who keeps going? Well, I don't care if the sun don't shine. Give my Lord an evening time when I'm with my baby. Ain't no matter if you see no snow, drive them cozy when the lights are low. When I'm with my baby, ain't no fun when the sun around. How gets going when the sun goes down? With my baby, what's when we're gonna kiss and kiss and kiss and kiss and gonna kiss some more? Guess how many times I kiss, cause in a time like this, who keeps going? I don't care if the sun don't shine. Give my Lord an evening time. For a while, and Scotty Moore lived there, and I had that that thing, you know, I'm not worthy, and I could never go over and say anything to him, so I never met him. I lived there for 7 years. I didn't have the balls to do it. He's still alive. I should go up there.
Yeah.
I can't do it. I got. Actually, even worse, I got inducted into the Musicians Hall of Fame, which is in Nashville.
Woo!
And the year before, he was inducted, and he didn't play. James Burton played in place of him, because he hurt his hand. And the guy that runs the Hall of Fame said, you should ask him, you know, you guys could play a duet or something. I went, oh my God, that would be unbelievable. So, but he said that through somebody else, that he couldn't play anymore because of arthritis. He couldn't play anymore. I went, oh well. And I have worse than that. It freaked me out so much being inducted into that thing that I couldn't even go to the ceremony. I was so weirded out. So I stayed home, and my friend called up with his cell phone and held up when I was inducted, held up the phone so I could hear it. I said, this is much better. It's actually very hard to get me out of the house nowadays. I didn't, like I say, when I got famous, I didn't like it. I didn't like people coming up to me all the time. And then, things worked out that, I wasn't so famous anymore. And I know what you're thinking I'm going to say, but I ain't going to say it. I like that. I like being able to walk down the street just like everybody else. I really like that. And so when I first moved to Boston, I was like, what's it going to be like here? So I went walking down the street with this girl that I was dating. And we were on this side street in Harvard Square. And this bus was following us. A regular bus. And he like beat the horn and he opened the door. And he said, "Welcome to Boston, Al." I said, "That's good. I don't mind that." And it's pretty good. I can go to Harvard Square and just walk around, no problems at all. And I like that. I prefer that. And then, see, I'm on tour now. This is the first night of the tour. And then I have to be Al Cooper. So that's like a whole other thing that I'm not when I'm in the house. So I'm at, what the hell am I playing now? Okay, this is a medley of songs similar to the opening of the set, but different tempo, that people always ask for and I never play. And the opening of the show that I did tonight, I've never did before. That was the first time I ever played it. I know you could tell. But it's only the first night. It'll be great by the sixth night. But this I have done before. So I hope you enjoy this. What it is that I can't, it's very hard to play this stuff with a band. And actually even harder to play it solo. But people really want to hear these songs. And the good thing about playing it solo is I don't have to teach it to all these other guys. Because when I was young, when I wrote the music to these songs, just like the guy said in college, you have to break the rules before you decide that that's bullshit. And so I didn't know the rules. So I wrote all this stuff that, like, is very complicated and doesn't follow the rules. And you do that when you're younger. I was just discussing this with another songwriter the other day. And then when you get older, just because so much time has passed, you have learned all the rules. And you can't go and do that anymore because you get stopped by something inside. You say, no, you can't do that. Like that. But when I was younger, I wrote these songs and they're like Alec, musically. And they're hard to play and it takes me like a week to learn each song and I wrote it. The sun coming through my window, just to say that my day's begun. The smile that's upon my mirror lets me know that my loved one's come. I'm not so much a man as I am one to understand a woman. I can love my woman with a love that's than a river, give her chills, make her shiver. I can love my woman. Lost in a world of nothing without my love beside me there. see that her eyes are smiling through the strands of her raven hair. Every day is a new day when I've got to win the love again of a woman. I could love my woman, strung inside a sweet caress, give her everything. Nothing less. I could love my woman.
Everything I say, New York City.
is a bluesy kind of tune. I wrote this with a band I was producing in 1973, and it was a lot of fun, and I didn't know this band was going to get so big, so this song pays my rent, and no one ever heard it.
My pistols in my pocket, boys, I'm out of bounty bound. I got my pistols in my pocket, boys, I'm out of bounty bound. Well, I'm not looking for no trouble, but no. Tri-cities, here I come. Well, now I'm going to fetch my woman, people. Tri-cities, here I come. Well, she was raised up on that cornbread. I know that woman, give me some. Give me some, baby. Just me either, and it's not just one record company, it's all of them. So I figure if I hadn't written so many songs, for real, I would be living in a cardboard box under a bridge in Pittsburgh, and that's how it is, and my friends who didn't write songs, you know, are in much tougher shape than I'm in, and I'm starting to feel in tough shape nowadays. So every February and August, what I call the cavalry comes, and miraculously I have enough money to get by. And what I'm doing now, this I do for fun. I mean, they do pay me. But I like to do this. I am, in case you couldn't tell, a frustrated comedian. And this gives me an opportunity to do what I call sit-down comedy. And the great thing about this is, if you don't laugh, I just play it on the stage. It's a big deal for me. So every 6 months, like I say, the royalty statement comes, and I have this little game. I go through, because you can get, like, literally, some songs get 3 cents for, you know, whatever period they're paying you for. And then they're all listed, and it tells how much they sold and what you get paid for. So this Diamond Ring, which is, you know, one of my really big songs, I only wrote 1/3 of it. And every song that you have that's published by somebody, which all my early songs were published, I don't own the publishing. So right off the top, the publisher takes 50%. And then you split the other 50% between the three guys. So it's not a big money earner. But I mean, compared to other songs that I wrote all by myself. But I get a plaque every 3 years. I think it's 4 million now. It says, "This Diamond Ring has been played on the radio over 4 million times. You poor people." But I'd like to see which song earned the most money in this time period. So I go through and I'm looking at it, and some strange things happen. In the early times of getting this money, this Diamond Ring was always the winner. And then things changed. And the Beastie Boys sampled The Flute Thing, the song from the Blues Project. And when they wanted to do this, their manager, who's friends with my lawyer, went to my lawyer and said, "Mike, we want to use Al's song on the album, and we want to use the sample by the Blues Project, but the publisher won't let us do it. They don't like our deal." So he said, "Well, what's your deal?" He said, "Well, if we sell 1 million records, they get Al gets $5,000. So I said, "What's wrong with that? I already wrote the song. I don't even have to do anything." So I had to myself call up the publisher and say, "Would you please grant them the license?" They said, "It's not a very good deal." I said, "They're going to sell 4 million albums at least. And then I'm going to get 5, 10, 15. I'm going to get $20,000 for not doing anything. I don't know about you, but I could really use that $20,000. It's not a good deal, Al." I said, "For you, it's not a good deal. For me, I can live another year." And they said, "Okay." So they did it. It sold 6 million albums. This is what you're up against in this business. So when that came out, that was the winner for that year. And the bizarre ones, there was a song that I wrote called Jolie.
Oh, yeah.
That must be someone in my family. It's a song on Naked Songs, right? The album Naked Songs, you don't know. Okay. So anyway, it was a song that I wrote. It's a nice song. It was almost recorded by Al Green, but almost doesn't count. And they used it for a commercial in Japan. Where, by the way, I'm bigger in that country than any country in the world. Don't ask me why. That's why I got hired here.
Ah, voila.
I got it now. So they used it for a commercial in Japan, and over a period of 3 royalty statements, I got 6 figures for that. Now, we call that in the music business mailbox money. Because, like I said, we didn't do nothing. I mean, I wrote the song in 1970, and it's recorded in 1972, and it's just laying there, doing nothing. It's going, let me out. And so they used it for this commercial, and all this money came flying in. And I looked at the statement, and I went, how much? For Jolie? And the other thing is, they don't tell you. Like, I once went to the movies and to see the new Robert Redford movie. It was called Sneakers. And I'm sitting there, this is when I lived in Nashville, and I love going to the first show because there's nobody there and you can put your feet up and, you know, it's good. It's like being at home. And so I went to the first show at the Lion's Head Cinema in Nashville. And I'm sitting there, and the movie starts, and I hear this music. I says, I know that. What is that? That's me. And I went, oh, ka-ching. Wow. And then a half hour later, they played it again. Ka-ching, ka-ching. But the best one was right after 9/11, I was booked on the David Letterman show to sit in with the band. And this was like when they first started putting the regular TV back on again. And everyone from Hollywood refused to go, that were booked on the show, refused to go because they didn't want to get on a plane. All the big stars and everything. So I was just in Boston. I took the train anyway. And so I said, I'll be there. And when I was there, they were so nice, and they said, thank you so much. You know, a lot of people are canceling left and right. I said, no, it's no big deal. I'll do it. And, I know the guys in the band. It's, like, really fun to play with them. So I went and did that. And then right after that, there was a bit on a Friday night where Paul Schaefer came out and sang my song and then got down on his knees, and a special guest came out, I think the first one was Nathan Lane, and put a cape around him like James Brown, you know? And they started doing this every Friday night with a different person every Friday night to put the cape around Paul. Now, with BMI and ASCAP, who pays you for things like this, you don't get paid until like a year later. So I didn't think it was going to be much money because I've had songs on those shows and it's not much money. But because it was the featured thing, where the camera was on Paul and everything, the money goes way up, like that. And they did this every Friday night. Now, during the year, they show reruns and stuff, and there's weeks where they take off and they show reruns and stuff like that. So it wasn't 52 times. Maybe it was 30 times. But that's a lot. And they did this for 3 years.
And I don't even watch David Letterman. But, you know, you can tape it. Or whatever it is that you're doing now that's not tape. We still call it taping. So I would tape it every Friday night, and I knew exactly where to go in the tape, because they did it at the same time, so I didn't have to watch the Letterman show. And I could get, you know, right to the beat. So over the course of the 3 years, they had Solomon Burke, I said Nathan Lane, Rudy Giuliani.
Oh, no.
The most bizarre people were on the show just to put the cape around Paul. And one night, I went to look at it, and there's James Brown.
Yeah.
Putting the cape on Paul. I said, oh my God, this has got to be the last episode.
Yeah.
How are they going to follow this? It wasn't the last one. They kept going. And then one night they had Paul Anka on, of all people. You're having my baby. And then, you know, when the song was over, Letterman would introduce the person who put the cape on, because they weren't introduced, they just came out. It's Paul Anka. And they give him a big hand, and then the orchestra starts playing, and he comes out. And he starts singing My Way, you know, which he wrote. And all the words have changed, and they're talking about all the people that put the cape on Paul. And they're showing clips of it, and I went, this is really the end. This has been a good run, but this is definitely the end. And then they took the cape, and they lifted it off the wall like they do when an athlete retires, and they put his number up. I put the cape up there, and I went, damn, that's good. And then, as I said, time had to pass before I got this money, and it was unbelievable, the money. I mean, beyond belief. And so I redid the master bathroom in my house. And we call it the David Letterman Memorial.
Nice.
And I got one of those toilets that you can get, you know, that does that, like, super power flush. I always wanted one of those. And that's the Paul Schaefer Memorial toilet.
Woo!
The song that he sang was I Love You More Than You'll Ever Know. And so for those 3 years, it was easily, you know, the winner in the royalty statement. And before that, because in 1972, Donny Hathaway recorded it. And before Donny Hathaway recorded it, the African-American population did not know that song. They never heard my record of it, I promise you. And then when Donny Hathaway recorded it, a whole new audience heard the song. And of course, the Donny Hathaway record is incredible. He was one of my favorite singers. I couldn't believe when I found out that he was going to record my song. And even wilder is some guy interviewed me on the phone from Paris about a month ago. He was doing a Donny Hathaway album for Paris, a memorial album of Donny Hathaway for Paris and for France. And so he interviewed me. He was a very nice guy, and we got along very good on the phone. And then he sent me an email with a recording of Stevie Wonder singing I Love You More Than You'll Ever Know from a live gig. He was actually paying tribute to Donny Hathaway, but he didn't even know he was paying tribute to me. And Stevie Wonder probably thinks that Donny Hathaway wrote the song. but I don't care. To have Stevie Wonder sing my song in my lifetime is one of the greatest things that ever happened to me. And so I'd like to do that song for you now with the original lyrics, because Donnie changed the lyrics. Actually, Jerry Wexler, who produced it, changed the lyric. When I wrote the song, I wrote this line, and I never sang the line until the night we recorded it. I mean, you know, we played gigs and stuff, and I sang some other line. And then I sang the line, which is, I could be president of General Motors. And everybody in the booth cracked up. And on the record, you can even hear me go like that. And but I was always hoping that an African-American would record the song, because it would mean so much more for them to sing that lyric. So here's Donny Hathaway. He's going to do it. What could be better, really? And so then Jerry Wexler sent me the cassette, and he took the line out, and he replaced it with one of the worst lines I ever heard in my life. It's, I could be king of everything. Wow. I wouldn't have written that line when I was 16. And so I called up Jerry Wexler, and I was furious. And I said, Jerry Wexler, please. Who's calling? Al Cooper. Just a minute.
Hey, Al, did you get that
tape I sent you? I said, yeah, why did you change the lyric?
He said, what are you talking about?
I said, I could be president of General Motors. He said, this is 1972. He said,
Al, a black man could never be president of General Motors.
And I said, you. And I hung up the phone, and I didn't talk to him for 25 years. And he put a curse on me. Jerry Wexler. He put a mojo on me. Because, like I said, once Donny Hathaway recorded that song, everybody recorded it. There must be at least 30 people that have recorded this song now. And Donny Hathaway changed the melody of the first line. So I go, if I ever leave you. And he goes, if I ever leave you, baby. Like that. So when I hear somebody sing the song, I don't even have to go to that part. If they sing, if I ever leave you, baby. Because I know they're going to say, I could be king of everything. And that's the curse that Jerry Wexler put on me. All these great people recorded the song with the wrong lyric. And this will go on till long after I'm dead. So that's why I still play it and I sing the right lyric.
If I ever leave you, you can say I told you so. And if I ever hurt you, baby, you know I hurt myself as well. Is that the way for a man to carry on? You think he wants his little loved one gone? I love you, baby. more than you'll ever know. More than you'll ever know. Tonight. You know where my paycheck went. You know I brought it home to my baby. And I never spent one round cent. Is that any way? Oh man, the carry-on. You think it won't as little won't I love you, babe. I really want to thank everybody for coming to my show tonight. I really appreciate it. It's so great to come out to San Francisco. And as I'm getting older, I'm actually dragging albums around to sell that I've never done before. So there in the lobby, if you're interested, my latest album, which is called White Chocolate. And there's a new one coming. I don't know when it'll be finished. But again, thank you so much for coming.
Please grab a Yoshi's San Francisco calendar on your way out. We have some fantastic shows.